for the talk this evening. I'm going to discuss a little bit about jnana as the fifth of the five khandhas. Consciousness, they're usually translated as. Cognition, sometimes. Awareness, perhaps. I'm beginning to like awareness as a translation. One is aware of something. And so this is the aspect of the mind which is just the pure knowing without doing anything, that Ajahn Brahm calls the knower rather than the doer. In talking about these five khandhas, I've tried to present a somewhat different picture than we get from traditional Theravadan sources. And of course, if you're interested in the, you know, the traditional explanation, then that's easy to be found in many books and explained very well and clearly. But I don't feel that that explanation exhausts the possibilities of meaning. And in particular, I've tried to emphasize that the five khandhas follow a developmental or an evolutionary structure. They're not just five random things put next to one another with no organic connection between them, but they reflect in an important way the actual development of us as sentient beings, of the structure of our experience and awareness, structure of our lives. And that reflects in various ways particular developmental models and evolutionary models of the human psyche, which have been developed by philosophers and thinkers in the past and the present. But I don't wish too much to explore the parallels here, but just to notice that if we're talking about a developmental perspective, then jnana is the highest level of that development. And I think it's fairly true to say that in its most explicit and central forms, it's the development of consciousness itself is a speciality of the Indian spiritual sphere, not so much the Western or Chinese spheres, except as they've come under the Indian influence. And we find in the Indian texts, and this goes right back as far as there are Indian texts, this concern for this difference between the knower and the doer. If you look in my office on the wall there, you'll see a picture of two parrots. Beautiful little picture done by Jhana, who I asked to draw this picture for me. And one parrot is sitting on the branch eating the fruit, and the other parrot's perched on the branch watching. And she did a very beautiful job of positioning the watching parrot's eye right in the center of the focus of the picture, and very clearly delineated the watching. And that picture was taken from a passage which is found right through the Brahmanical scriptures, found in the Rig Veda, in the chapter on the Vishvadevas. They're like two birds sitting, constant companions, sitting on a branch. One eats the fruit and the other watches over without eating. And this little simile repeated countless times through the Brahmanical literature. And that encapsulates in that perfect form, a perfect image, that distinction is exactly the same distinction that Ajahn Brahm calls the knower and the doer. The doer is eating the fruit, the knower is just watching. And that aspect of just watching has a gentleness to it, it has a passivity to it. The doing, the active side of the mind, which we discussed earlier with the sankhara, is more it's assertive. It does things, it constructs, it creates. Vijnana just watches, it observes. It's more passive. What's going on? What's happening? And as such, vijnana is the gateway to knowledge, to understanding. And this, of course, working together with the other aspects. And one example of that I remember from my time in Malaysia. And we built a kuti there inside the middle of the mountain in Sukawana. And it was the first time I'd ever designed and had built a kuti. And the whole kuti was built and that was fine. And then we put these blinds on the outside to stop the rain coming in. Didn't have windows, just wire mesh, fly screen. And we put blinds on the outside for when it rains. And we couldn't get them to work. And there were a couple of the guys who were installing them. They couldn't get them to, you know, they're supposed to pull the rope and then they kind of rolled themselves up. But they wouldn't roll. They just kind of clumped on the way up and they wouldn't roll properly. And I was just standing next to the work site, just watching, you know, a couple of guys working, trying to fix the problem, work out why they wouldn't roll properly. And while I was standing there, somebody came up the stairs. You had to come up through a little tunnel and then up the stairs, and they kind of saw what was going on and they said, "Oh, it's because the rope is wrong. You need to change the string rope over and get a different kind of string." And then he walked off. A little while later, somebody else came up. He said, "Oh, no, it's because the material on the blinds are made of. It's too slippery. You need to get another kind of material." And then he went off. And somebody else came up and said, "No, it's because the rods at the bottom are not heavy enough. You need to change those." And then he went off. And I was just kind of sitting watching all of this. Of course, the problem in the end wasn't any of those things. It was something, I can't remember what it was now, but it wasn't any of those things. So in that case, you know, you see that the doer, of course, the bloke's building the thing, actually getting it done, and then that's this kind of scene of activity and always kind of wanting to do things. And so these other guys coming along and saying, you know, you should do it like this, you should do it like that. And then that's how sankhara works. It's always sort of coming up with things, it's always projecting ideas, projecting kind of things. And of course, none of them knew anything about what they were talking about, right? They'd never actually built anything like that before. And I was like, in that stage, I was like the observer. So I was just watching. So that's the vijnana. And so you just watch the process. And then you learn something, yeah? One thing you learn is that everybody's always got a different opinion on a building site. And usually none of them know what they're talking about. So that's one thing I learned from that, and I carry that with me today. But you just kind of watch that process and you see that sankhara actually bubbles up, doesn't it? Like thoughts in the mind, they bubble up seemingly at random. Intentions, wishes, we're just sitting there, oh, we reach out, we go to do something, we grab a pen, we grab a book. We don't know where that comes from. It's like a spontaneous emergence. And we get caught up in things. So sankhara is always caught up in the details of the activity. Vijnana just watches, it's just looking over. Just watching. And so in this respect, that aspect of observing is of course crucial in science, for example. And the activity of society, if you look at how Western thought kind of developed, you started out with the philosophers and the theologians who worked from principles of pure reason. This is a Platonic idea that you start with principles that are self-evident and you reason from that, draw inferences from that. And so that's based on Sankara. And then Galileo and others came along and they said, no, you have to observe. Is the most important thing, is start with observing and gathering empirical data, measuring, and then you can infer from that. And so this is one of the innovations of the scientific method, is it's based on observation and the idea that that observation has to somehow be detached, so we're not involved with what we're watching. We stand back. The scientist stands aside from the experiment and just objectively observe what's going on. Of course, that's the theory. The reality, of course, is that that never happens. The reality is that the scientist is always involved in the experiment in some way or another. So what science depends on is making assumptions, trying to remove the impact of the observer, trying to minimize the impact of the observer so that it doesn't impact on the experiment too much. Yeah. And so the observer has to be quiet. Yeah, that's the kind of the scientific experimental. The observer just watches. If you're an anthropologist, you go in, you watch. You go into how people are working and so on. Like the Freud's idea, yeah? You sit the couch, someone's on a couch in front of you, you sit behind them, you just listen. You're not interfering more than absolutely necessary. So this is trying to remove the involvement of the doer and get a bit more distance about it. And this is intrinsic to the scientific project. And Dr. Eng Kong told me that Freud had said that when you're listening to a patient, that you have to use what Freud used the term evenly suspended attention. Evenly suspended attention. And that's actually quite a beautiful phrase and a beautiful encapsulation of the attitude of mind that we bring to meditation. Of course, Freud didn't explain how to do that. He just said you should do it. There wasn't a method for it. And it wasn't until psychologists learnt from Buddhism that they learnt actually how to train that faculty. So in training our vijnana, we're training that faculty of, if you like, that phrase, evenly suspended attention, or that phrase of like mindful awareness, or many different ways of putting it. Now, one fallacy and problem to be avoided, and one which I think is made very commonly in Buddhist meditation teachings, it's basically the same fallacy that the scientists make when they imagine that somehow they're not involved in their experiments and that they don't influence their experimental outcomes. And that's the fallacy, similar fallacy is of thinking that somehow, so for example, use Krishnamurti's phrase, choiceless awareness, okay? That this act of being aware is in fact a choiceless awareness, right? And I think that's a misleading kind of phrase. It's going too far. Maybe that might be an ideal, but in fact one is always directing or controlling the consciousness in some way, and one shouldn't imagine that you're not, okay? So that we're reducing gradually the involvement of the doer, little bit by little bit, but you can't just eliminate it, you can't just drop it away. It's part of how consciousness works. In Buddhist psychological theory, this is expressed through what they call the sabbasadharana jetasika, which is five mental factors which are present in all at all times in consciousness. There's feeling, perception, attention, intention, and contact. So these are always present. even in very deep, profound states of samadhi. So maybe we think about in arupa jhanas or like the cessation, then maybe these things cease then if we're talking very exotic states of mind. But in any ordinary state of consciousness, even in form jhanas, these things are always present. Even if they're present in a highly refined and attenuated form, so fair enough, they're not necessarily present in the same way, they've changed, but there's still something there. So when we're talking about this bare awareness, choiceless awareness, evenly suspended awareness, we shouldn't think of that as, you know, it's not something that's unconditioned. It's not something which is inherently pure. Okay? It's just a state of mind. It's a state of mind which has qualities of poise and balance and awareness, which gives us the space to be able to see and to understand. Now, if we look at how vijnana is treated in the suttas, we find two rather different kinds of treatments and two correspondingly rather different schools of thought about vijnana in the present day. Perhaps I should mention before going on to that something I've mentioned a number of times in talks over the months or the years, but it should be repeated. There's a bit of a controversy in Buddhist history, and it's been an issue in the present day, of the different terms for the mind used in the Pali or in the scriptures. And you basically have three main terms: vijnana, citta, and mano. And the question is, are these the same or different? And one school of thought says that they all refer to the same thing, and there are some passages where they clearly are used as synonyms. The other school of thought says that they refer to different things, and it's certainly possible to find differences of usage among those terms. And my position is that they refer to pretty much the same kind of thing, but that they tend to get used in different kinds of ways. Vijnana tends to get used under the first noble truth of dukkha. Mano, so it's under the five aggregates and so on. Mano is more active. It tends to get used under the second noble truth. Yeah, mano kamma. It's more the dynamic part of mind. And citta is used very broadly, in just to mean, you know, the mind or heart or something, in very general, ordinary, everyday language. But when it's used in a technical sense, it's usually used under the fourth noble truth, the citta bhavana, development of the mind, where it's a more or less a synonym of samadhi. So this is that kind of difference in usage, just a tendency, not a black and white distinction. But we also find the usage of vijnana under the fourth noble truth. Okay, so for example, the base of infinite consciousness. Okay, one of the formless jhanas, and so therefore part of the path, something to be developed. And so to come back to that point I mentioned before, that there are two rather different treatments of vijnana, then this is an example of one kind of treatment. Here we have this phrase, anantang vijnanam. Consciousness is infinite. Awareness is infinite. And so here we seem to be talking about something like that's very big. We're talking about an expansive awareness. We're talking about something that has like a fluidity or a continuity about it. Perhaps we might draw a connection between that and certain usages, like say we have the vijnana sota. It's like a stream of consciousness which flows on from one life to the next. The samvatthanika vijnana, the evolving consciousness, quite literally the evolving consciousness that moves from one lifetime to the next. Vijnanang anidasanang, you know, the non-manifestive consciousness. Yeah, we find a phrase in the Kingsuka Sutta where the The Vijnana is described as being like the lord of the city that sits in the middle at the crossroads. So all of these kinds of contexts suggest quite a pregnant and powerful meaning for Vijnana. It's something which is seems to be like a principle of like continuity, of identity, like a central unifying and like encompassing principle in the mind. So this is one way that Vijnana is treated in the suttas. Another way that it's treated, you know, is the kind of the more standard analytical way. You have eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness. And so in that sense it seems to be not that same expansive and cosmic kind of dimension, but much more reductive and psychological, just awareness of sights. There's nothing particularly, I mean, it's the very fact of awareness itself is very mysterious. You know, but it's, we're not talking about it, you know, kind of a great mystical state or cosmic state or anything, just an ordinary empirical sense operation, awareness of sights, awareness of sounds, and so on and so forth. And so there's these two rather different kinds of ways of treating Vijnana, and people have drawn rather different kinds of conclusions from that. Of course, in the traditional Theravadin approach is to emphasize that the reductive analytical approach is the ultimate reality. Right? That Vijnana is nothing more than discrete moments of sense consciousness. And this is the way it tends to be taught in the present day by those who are more influenced by the Theravadin commentarial and Abhidhamma literature. On the other hand, we find those who tend to emphasize more the idea of like a kind of maybe an original mind or a kind of unconditioned consciousness, a kind of cosmic consciousness. And this is kind of drawing from these other passages, these other texts, and drawing inferences from them. And they seem to speak of, whilst sort of skirting around the issue, but the basic trend is to identify some kind of infinite or cosmic or unconditioned consciousness with Nibbana, and to say that the goal of Buddhism, Buddhist practice, is to realize this kind of unconditioned consciousness. That's another kind of trend of thought that we find. Of course, you know, we think of people like Venerable Tanisaro, the Peter Harvey's book, The Selfless Mind, Rune Johansson's book, The Psychology of Nirvana, and so on and so forth. And of course, the fact is that the texts to justify both of those positions are both found within the Pali Canon and similar literature. And it depends on how you interpret them. And in my view, I think both of those perspectives, or the reason why there's a problem between those perspectives, is because there's an insufficient acknowledgement of the historical context and meaning of what Vijnana is being talked about and what the Buddha was doing. In other words, taking the Buddha's words as being more kind of absolute, timeless statements, rather than taking them as being contextual responses to particular ideas and practices that were present in his environment. And so, of course, I'm thinking of the yogis and sages whose teachings, Yajnavalkya and so on, we find in the Upanishads, the teachers of the sheer mass of consciousness, Vijnana Ganameva, which is the ocean of the self. And those teachings seem to me to be embodied, a large part of the Buddha's teachings, in fact, to me seem to be a critique of just those teachings. Now, when we look at what these Upanishadic sages are saying, we find that actually they're very beautiful teachings, and it's a very lovely and subtle kind of philosophy that they're and it's difficult to say, you know, it seems like a kind of a meditative, contemplative philosophy that they're espousing. And, you know, we find this kind of idea in Yajnavalkya, he has this phrase, neti, neti, not that, not that. Yeah. And he's saying it's not for the sake of cattle, it's not for the sake of friends, it's not for the sake of family, it's not for the sake of, you know, the eye, the ear, the tongue, the nose, the body. Not for the sake of these things, but for the sake of the self. And so they're moving to this idea of the self. And Yajnavalkya speaks of this place of convergence. And if you've read History of Mindfulness, you know this idea of ekayana, found in the Satipatthana Sutta, is almost certainly derived from Yajnavalkya's teachings, ekayana, this place of convergence. All the sights converge in the eye, the sounds converge in the ear, the smells converge in the nose. Yeah, the speech converges in the Vedas. Everything, and this idea of where everything comes together, the rivers all converge into the ocean. Where everything comes together, where everything comes to be one. This is ekayana. This is what Satipatthana is. It's the path to the ekayana. It's the path to where everything becomes one. And what is that place where everything becomes one? It is just that vijñāna ganameva, that sheer mass of consciousness. And so the Upanishads are constantly speaking of the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the unknown knower. What is it that cannot be seen and yet sees? What is it that cannot be heard and yet hears? What is it that cannot be thought and yet thinks? What is it that cannot be known and yet knows? So according to the highest teachings in the Upanishads before the Buddha, that was the self. That unknown knower, yeah? That pure observer, that was what knows. And so there's this disidentification from the objects of experience, yeah? And those objects of experience were called nama rupa, okay? And they're like each river has its own shape and its own name, its own nama and its own rupa. But they all go down and they merge into that great ocean, and that great ocean of consciousness is vijñāna. This again is the teaching from the Upanishads. So this idea of vijñāna as a cosmic universal consciousness is precisely the teaching that we find as the highest and most profound philosophical development before the time of the Buddha. And I think we can agree that it's a very beautiful idea. It's one which comes from a profound level of contemplative development and a profound sense of awareness, and also a profound sense of letting go. You know, there is that idea of a self, but that idea of a self comes from neti, neti, not that, not that, not that, letting go of so much. And one's able to come back to just that inner sense of awareness. The unknown knower. And so this bears on that question of, you know, well then what really is vijñāna? Do we understand it in this reductive sense as just eye consciousness and so on and so forth, or is it in this expansive sense, which sense is correct or final? You know, sometimes we hear etymological explanations from it, and I've heard, you know, people, modern monks who say that vijñāna means discriminative or separative knowing, separative consciousness. And they justify that by saying that we means separation, jnana means knowing, so vijnana means separative knowledge. But in the Indian exegetical tradition, the Shankara, who knew a thing or two about Sanskrit etymology, analyzed vi in vijnana not as separative or discriminating, but as infinite. So the vi in jnana, the inherent meaning of the word, is not discriminative at all. It's not separative. The basic meaning of the word is rather infinite knowledge, like a comprehension, an all-round awareness. And of course that's exactly the usage that we do find in these kind of expansionist things. We find anantang vijnanam, the infinite consciousness and so on, and this terminology, this way of talking about vijnana, which is basically exactly the same as we find in the Upanishads. And so in the teachers who want to try to argue that this usage of vijnana is the ultimate or the highest sense of vijnana, of course have a major problem, which is that if that's the case, then how is that different from what the Upanishads are teaching? And as far as I'm aware, nobody's even substantially begun to grapple with that problem. And I think it's just insurmountable. The fact remains that if you say that infinite consciousness is the goal of the Buddha's teaching, you are teaching the same thing as the Upanishads taught. Whether that's right or wrong, but that's, you're teaching the same thing. In the passage which is central to that position and which is cited again and again, vijnanang anidasanang anantang sabbato babhang, consciousness that is non-manifestative, infinite and radiant all around. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Consciousness that is not manifested, infinite, radiant all around. So it sounds like that's something pretty out there. And, you know, of course the passage and the verse itself is subject to various kinds of interpretations. But to me subject to various kinds of interpretations, which I won't go into right at the moment. Simply to mention that the second part of that same verse then says, vijnanasa nirodhena ete tang uparujyati. Yeah? With the cessation of vijnana, here all these things come to an end. Yeah? And so the very same verse which is seeming to be speaking about vijnana in this very exalted sense is also speaking of vijnanasa nirodhena, with the cessation of consciousness, the cessation of awareness. So when we understand this context and this usage, and you can see that while we cannot accept that this expansionist interpretation of vijnana expresses like the Buddha's ultimate position on it, but it also calls into question whether the reductionist perspective can also be regarded as an ultimate position. Because the reductionist perspective now appears to be quite specifically a critique of the expansionist perspective. That thing which you are taking as the self, which is that infinite consciousness, which is that radiant awareness, yeah, which is that ocean of awareness, which is that unknown knower, which sits in the middle, like the Lord in the sitting in the middle of the city at the crossroads, knowing all that is around it and being presented with the objects of knowledge. That is just a psychological process. That mental identification that you're talking about, if you analyze that, you can see that what's happening in your eye is actually very similar. Yeah? And this is something which, you know, you find in various of the Indic texts, is that you've got like this purisa, this person who lives in the eye. Yeah? And it's the person who lives in the eye who sees. Yeah? So it's the idea that the senses themselves have a subject. So that the basic way that eye consciousness works, ear consciousness, nose, tongue, body consciousness works, is pretty much the same basic way that the mind works. Of course, the mind is much more complex, but the same basic principles apply. And so we start with the sense consciousness, which is more easy to grapple with. Yeah? We investigate that in meditation. You have a subjective sense. I'm sitting here, I have a point of view. Yeah? I'm here in a place, I can look, I can see around. From this point of view, the world is spread out before me and around me. I am the center of this visual field. Yeah? That visual field itself has certain qualities. It has a certain shape. It has like a kind of ovalish kind of shape. It disappears off towards the edges and focuses and becomes more clear in the middle. It varies in terms of its steadiness. It varies in terms of its focus. It varies in terms of the intensity of awareness. Yeah? And so it's always changing. So we can investigate these things. We know that when we're sitting here in a dark space, that our eyes become very sensitive. When we go into a bright space, it'll seem too glaring, the eyes will retract, and so on. So the quality of consciousness is changing according to conditions. And so this is something which we can actively investigate in meditation. And just to watch that, just to be that eye consciousness, just to focus on that. And then ask, what is that unseen seer? And of course, that unseen seer is not something you can't see. That you can't see the eye consciousness with the eye. Yeah, you can look in a mirror, and you just see the eyeball. You can't see the eye consciousness. So the eye consciousness can't see itself. The eye can't see itself, even without the aid of a mirror. And so we investigate this as a paradigm for what consciousness is, what vijnana is. And then we realize that vijnana, as it happens in the eye, is essentially conditioned. It's not that it may be conditioned sometimes and maybe it can't be. By its very nature, it's conditioned. It's dependent on the existence of some kind of external stimulus that can provoke it into being. Yeah, there has to be some kind of sight, even if the sight is just blackness. Yeah, but in that case, then the stimulus comes from inside. You know, you want to look at it. So there has to be something there to provoke it. So this is where you have this thing pasa, which they translated as contact, but actually the stimulus is quite a good translation of it as well. The physical basis of the eye, the external sense stimuli, and the internal consciousness, they come together. We call that contact. So contact isn't anything, right? Contact is that coming together. It's that edginess of things is what contact is. It's not actually a separate thing in itself. And this is one little detail which was actually why I stopped believing in the Pali commentaries. This tiny little detail in the suttas, it says, Dhyanang Sangati Paso, the coming together of the three is contact. And that's glossed in the commentaries. It says, Dhyanang Sangati Ya Paso. Just a little difference. Just a little adjective there. From the coming together of the three is contact. Yeah? In other words, pasa is a separate thing. It's not that moment of interaction is not contact anymore, but contact is another thing which we've reified and we've turned into its own kind of thing. But that's not what the Buddha meant when he's talking about contact. Yeah? When two people come together in a room, they speak to each other, they contact each other. There's no third thing that comes into being when they contact each other. What there is an interaction. That's what contact is. And vijnana arises in that context. Vijnana is part of that interaction. It's the observing part of that interaction. Just watching. Yeah. And it's always there, but we don't always pay attention to it. So when other aspects of the five khandhas are predominant, so for example, again, sticking with the idea of seeing, you know, maybe we're driving along in the car and we're seeing things and we're drawn out. And so we focus on the external, the rupa. We see billboards, we see cars driving, we see people by the side of the road. We see things and we're going out to the... And so we're not focusing on the eye consciousness. We're not focusing on the quality of the vision, visual consciousness itself. We're focusing on the object. So this is always the tendency. Consciousness moves outwards. So it's sometimes... Vijnana is sometimes translated as awareness of. So it captures that kind of nuance. Moving out, it's awareness of something. And so this kind of practice is very good to do. And this is the kind of vipassana practice that we can do through investigating especially the five physical senses. And as we do that more and more, we're like training our mind, conditioning our mind to see also the awareness, sixth sense awareness, much more subtle awareness of the mind consciousness as being essentially similar. Not, of course, not the same in all ways, but working in a similar kind of fashion. And similarly, you have the internal consciousness, the external stimulus, okay, which is we call the Dhamma. It's like an object of mind. So a Dhamma can be any of the other four khandhas can be a Dhamma. So it can be a rupa in the sense of an internal imagination, like a vision or something you see internally, a sight. This is a rupa, which is perceived by the mind, not perceived by the eye. Can be a Vedana, perception, in fact it usually has all of those things mixed up with it somehow or other. Seen by the eye. And then you have this Manodhatu, which is actually a bit mysterious. Manodhatu, for each of the five senses, the dhatu, the eye dhatu is just the eye. You have the eye and the physical eye and the physical ear and so on and so forth. Whereas for the mind, you have the Manodhatu, one wonders exactly what's meant by that. Some people interpret it as the brain. Whether that's the case or not, I'm not quite sure. So these things come together and there has to be what's called an appropriate act of attention. Okay, so that one has to actually pay attention to these things. And it's that act of how we pay attention which is essentially what we're training when we're doing meditation. Again, come back to that phrase, the evenly suspended attention. Evenly suspended attention. Just watching over. Now, in that watching over with a quietness and a coolness of mind, then the quality of the ability to perceive the externals, the sense data, including the mind sense data, that becomes more refined. It's like you're increasing the resolution. You're taking a photo with your camera or something like that and you keep increasing the resolution. You actually see more finely grained into reality. The quality gets better. And the more and more that you can keep that sense of quietness and tenderness, the more that quality will improve, will just get clearer and clearer. And this is not anything mysterious, it's something you've all seen. We've all experienced the fact that when you come to sit meditation, suddenly the ticking of the clock in your room becomes very loud. Yeah, that's because your ear consciousness is becoming purified. Yeah? And that thing which previously you didn't notice now becomes so strong, you know, or an itch. You had an itch in your arm and you know, you never even noticed it before. And then you're sitting there and it becomes so painful, so annoying. Yeah? So this is how your consciousness is becoming more conscious, your awareness is becoming more aware, your knowing knows better. So this is why we need that very gentle and that very tender environment to allow the mind to open up to that sense of knowing. And this is why I really love the one of the Greek myths of Cupid and Psyche, and love and the soul, because psyche like the soul, or you can understand it as the mind. And it's a very beautiful story about how the love and the soul fell in love with each other, and then have all the usual kind of problems and so on, and eventually they could get married and had a daughter, and the daughter's name was Pleasure. And that's a very, very beautiful myth for understanding the way of meditation, that when you're developing that sense of consciousness and awareness, then there has to be a sense also of tenderness and love in there as well. And so this is where sometimes in teaching Buddhist meditation, I think it goes over like too much. You have this kind of bare awareness school, you know, and let's say a lot of, say, Zen meditation, and so on, where it's very much focusing on just awareness and just that kind of dry side of things. But that will never go that deeply. Yeah? And that kind of dry sense of awareness, that kind of standing back and just and watching, also has to be there with a sense of love and a sense of tenderness and care. Those two things have to be together, they have to be married. And when we find that balance in meditation, that kind of unity, then you find a consciousness starting to become one-pointed, starting to become unified. And we begin to dive into that ocean of consciousness. The idea of consciousness as an experience becomes not just the theory of it. Not just the idea of it, not just kind of a recognition, but it's starting to become your world. It's then becoming an immersion in it. It's not just something that you can see, but you start to realize that it is the seeing itself. There's nothing else outside of this consciousness. And you can begin to understand why, say, the Upanishadic yogis would be so overwhelmed with these kinds of experiences, why they would, you know, be affected so profoundly to think that this is in fact the ocean of being. Yeah? You know, and those ideas which were 1,000 years after the Buddha, taken up and made by the Yogacara school, and made one of the tenets of the later development of the Yogacara school also. Yogacara, of course, meaning the practice of meditation. And so that meditation school tends to come to this kind of apprehension, and I think this is also, you know, you've seen a similar development in Thailand among the forest tradition, with a very strong emphasis on samadhi development, and then sort of philosophically getting this kind of idea of the original mind and so on, which is related to that. Whether that's historically related to Yogacara is quite possible. But not certain. but it's certainly related to that nature of the meditative experience. And so we start to go into that, and you start to go in and to realize that this is our life, our being, our world. This is where we've actually been all along, but we just haven't noticed it. We've been so distracted looking outside, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought. We've been noticing all of those things so much that we haven't noticed that which is closest to us. We forget. We're like the fish who's never seen, doesn't know what water is. And we start to go inside that place where everything comes together. And of course this word ekayana, the coming together of everything. And it comes together in various kinds, it's like stacked and packaged and put together in various kinds of ways. It comes together in terms of the diversity of sense consciousness recedes and the unity of mind consciousness becomes predominant. That's one kind of meaning, like one-pointedness or convergence. Another meaning is that all of the different aspects of the mind are working together as they should do, rather than fighting each other and competing for attention and not quite fitting in together. And so you realize, oh, that's how things are supposed to work. And that's actually a very profound insight. You realize how dysfunctional our mind is normally, how it works on such kind of random levels, and so many kind of things just don't fit together and sort of grating against each other and so on all the time. And now that thing's actually coming together. And this is just one of the meanings when we talk about the five khandhas. Actually, almost always in the suttas, it doesn't say the word khandha, it says the word upadana khandha, the khandhas of grasping. The grasping khandhas or grasped at khandhas. And what that means is, in the Khanda Sanyutta, it talks about the four khandhas, form, feeling, perception, sankharas. When they stand against consciousness. Okay, they stand on one side, consciousness on the other. They come together. So this is telling us this is what upadana is. It's grasping. The four fingers grasping together with the thumb. Vijnana is the thumb. It locks everything into place. Yeah? And so that's what that coming together is. That instead of our mind being all over the place, everything's come together. We grasp. Like that. And so again, you know, the grasping, the upadana, is not something which exists separately either in or outside of the five khandhas, but it's how the five khandhas work. They grasp onto an object. And so of course normally we grasp like monkeys grasp. We're sort of out here and out there and trying to get there and monkey mind getting this and that. But when mind's becoming purified in meditation, we grasp rightly. And so this is what the Buddha said. And I asked him once, he was talking about the neither perception nor non-perception, and Ananda said something like, oh, that seems pretty good, wouldn't mind grasping onto that. And the Buddha said, well, he said, okay, if you've got to grasp onto something, then you can grasp onto that. That's the best thing to grasp onto. So this is like the last, Ajahn Brahm calls the last bastion of the self. Yeah. This kind of sense of perfection and unity that comes with an immersion in that oceanic purifying radiant awareness. And we understand why so many people said this is yourself. It feels exactly like a self should feel. Yeah? And if we start getting ideas about this and start calling this the unconditioned, yeah, the original mind and so on and so forth, and start developing theories around it, then we start to get attached to it. We're not able to let go. But if we've done our homework, if we've done our vipassana meditation beforehand, then we won't do that. We've investigated the five sense consciousness. We know that each of those is impermanent. We've investigated the mind consciousness. We know that that is impermanent. We know it's conditioned. We know it's suffering. We know it's not a self. And then we investigate that experience. When we come out of that experience, we investigate, we reflect on it, we know that that too is conditioned. And so there's some beautiful passages in the suttas that talk about that that moment. And one passage that comes to mind where it says, reflecting on that, I can't remember exactly now, it says one neither forms a volition or creates an intention for being in any state or other. Yeah. And then neither forming a volition, I think it's abhisankaroti or abhisanchetayati, neither creating an intention, then the mind becomes cool right there. One lets go and the mind becomes cool right there. That's not an exact quote. But this is this idea that at that moment, that mind is incredibly powerful. Right? And so this is the revelation of vijnana, the revelation of the power within vijnana is if you look in the Buddhist cosmology, you know, the Brahma gods who imagine that they're creators of the whole cosmos. Well, why do they imagine that they're the creators of the whole cosmos? Because they've practiced jhanas, and because their minds are so powerful that they feel that there's nothing that they can't do. That's the revelation of purified vijnana when it appears, is that it's so powerful that it feels like God. It feels like the force that creates the universe. And of course it's quite right, it is the force that creates the universe. And so like the habit of the mind, the subtle tendency to want to be in that state, or want to remain in that state, of course, is what naturally comes at that time, this abhisankaroti, abhisanchetayiti. One has a wish or a volition. In other words, one like grabs onto that, and one like extrapolates it, pushes it into the future. And of course, if you do that, you can get reborn in the Brahma realms or Rupa Loka or whatever, depending on what level of samadhi that you've reached. And then you enjoy that for a very long time. And then the power of that, awesome and incredible as it is still finite. And it still will pass away, and then you return to samsara. But at that moment, because this is that most refined and highest and most subtle resort or abiding of the idea of self, when we're able to let go of that, that's when vijnana sanirodhena etetam uparunjati, the ending of consciousness, all of this comes to an end. All comes to an end. So that ending of consciousness, ending of vijnana, ending of awareness, is how the Buddha described Nibbana, not once or twice, but dozens of times in Dependent Origination and description of the khandhas and many other places. Vijnana ends, awareness ends. Can we imagine that? And so this is where our ability to grapple with these things really just disintegrates. We're already even talking about vijnana as like an ocean of awareness or something like that. We're already grappling with the kind of exotic metaphors and stretching our potential for understanding into areas where you know it becomes very tenuous, and where it's very easy for a metaphorical suggestion to be turned into a metaphysical reality. But then if we go beyond that, not merely the unknown knowing, but no knowing at all. What is that? What is that like? Of course, it's not like anything. We try to imagine what it would be like to realize Nibbana. And of course, when we imagine that, we always imagine, what would it be like for me to realize Nibbana? But of course, the realization of Nibbana is precisely the ending of me. So our imagination just slides off it. Our attempts to pin it down one way or the other are doomed to failure. And you know, for all the words and so on that have been spilt in modern books and so on, trying to get a clearer idea of what Nibbana is, I think that for me the key insight for understanding how the Buddha talked about Nibbana is understanding this distinction. It's a very simple distinction. Nibbana is ontologically negative and psychologically positive. And if we understand that, then we can understand how and why the Buddha talked about it. It's ontologically negative in the sense that it's always described as in terms, when it was talked about in terms of existence, it's always a negative. There is the unborn, the unmade, the uncreated, the unbecome. And it's always a negative in terms of existence. It's always a negative, but when it's in terms of psychologically, Nibbanam paramang sukham. Nibbana is ultimate bliss. So the Buddha was trying to draw us into it by evoking an emotional, a positive emotional response to the idea of Nibbana, the shelter, the far shore, the place of safety, the place of refuge, and so on and so forth, the sublime, the peaceful. And so creating this positive emotional response, this resonance that wants to draw us towards that, and yet at the same time denying any possibility of making some kind of metaphysical reality out of it by sort of pinning it down in some ontological category or other. And again, you know, schools of thought on Nibbana, like the schools of thought on vijnana, you know, we have the two, the kind of the expansionist and the reductionist schools of thought, whereas in fact the text, what we have is a tension between those, a dynamic between those. And similarly with Nibbana, you know, we try to either reduce Nibbana to nothingness, or we try to make it into some kind of positive, you know, state of, you know, blissful awareness or whatever it might be. But actually, what we find in the text is a dynamic between those two things. It resists a once and for all solidification into one point of view, so that if we do come along and solidify it into one side, inevitably that will wear down and break over and seep over into the other side. So the texts are always breaking down those attempts to solidify and find one final formulation once and for all. And one final thing that I just want to reinforce a has a lesson to be drawn from this consideration, or this way of considering the five khandhas as a whole, as a developmental paradigm, is that we have to develop all of them. And it's simply not going to work just to develop jnana and to think I'm going to come and sit down and do my meditation and purify my mind and I haven't developed all of those other things. Okay, that's not the proper development of the Eightfold Path that the Buddha taught. If we look at the Eightfold Path, it actually has all of those elements within it. Okay? It has the elements of rupa is inherent in, say, in the care of the body through right livelihood. Vedana is there in several different aspects, but in terms of, say, the right intention, which is like has a kind of emotional connotation to it, also in the development of samadhi and so on. Sanya is there, for example, in language, you know, using the concepts and conceptualizing aspects. Sankara also there, present in language and in right action and so on, acting and doing the right effort, doing things the right way. And vijnana is present there, especially in terms of right samadhi and the awareness. So all of these five khandhas are actually present within the Eightfold Path and are to be developed in that way as part of the Eightfold Path. And so sometimes, you know, when we treat these five khandhas under the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, then of course they're treated in a deprecating way. They're impermanent, they're suffering, they're not self. Don't get attached to it. Don't get attached to your sannyas, to your perceptions, your memories, your associations. Don't get attached to your thinking. And, you know, sankharas are very highly deprecated in Buddhist culture. You know, it's just pungdang, they call it in Thailand. You know, the kind of the pungdang, can't translate pungdang, the confections of the mind, the makeups of the mind. The meaningless activity of the mind, which you have to get rid of in meditation. So of course that's true. Of course it's true that, you know, a lot of our thinking and thought and so on is useless and a waste of time, and we need to quiet that in meditation. But it's also true that thought is a constructive force which we need to develop in a mature way as part of our spiritual practice. So we have to resist attempts to reify and absolutize these things. Similarly with meditation, people will deprecate the development of consciousness. You're just getting attached to refined states of awareness, blah 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 blah. If only. and you know, this is something I've seen, the greatest improportion of rhetoric that's delivered to criticize states of advanced consciousness compared to the actual reality of the problem itself, you know. It's not something I've encountered often in my 15 years as a monk, is people who are just going off and sitting there indulging and getting attached to jhanas all day, okay. I'm sure it has happened once or twice, but it's not particularly a big problem in my experience. To keep this balanced perspective on these things, that yes, they are anicca, dukkha, anatta, they are impermanent, suffering, not self. We know that. That's part of our investigation, part of our practice. Another part of our practice is to develop them in a wholesome and positive way. And the outcome of that is the letting go. And this is where the upadana, the grasping, lets go, and lets go of all the five khandhas. So this is my little talk for you this evening on vijnana.